Welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 21st, 2001, and this is a recording of Richard Robum titled Calling by Name Plant Identification. The tape number is 2001-04. Let's listen in.
What we need to do in observance of summer solstice is the cuckoo song. This is either the first or the second poem in any English language anthology, and it's the second. Just about the first thing in Middle English that was recorded. And it was sung by monks at a monastery in England, starting maybe sometime around the 12th or 13th century. That makes it Middle English because it came after the Norman invasion in 1066, and the language changed considerably then. Became much more like a modern English. But here it is. First, I'll translate for you, and you can sort of dope it out. It's sing cuckoo now, sing cuckoo. Summer is a coming in. Loudeth, sing cuckoo. Groweth seed and bloweth mead as blooms the meadow. And springs the wood anew, and the old wood sprouts. Sing cuckoo. Awa bladeth after lamb, ewe bleats after the lamb, loweth after calf, cow. Bullock sturteth, that means leap, so the bullock leaps. Bucka verteth, that's just what you think it means. The buck farts. Mary sing cuckoo. Well singest thou cuckoo. Ne swipe thou never knew is, and don't ever stop. Nor cease thou never now. So here we go. Sing cuckoo now. Sing cuckoo. Sing cuckoo. Sing cuckoo now. Summer is a coming in. Loudest sing cuckoo. Groweth seed and bloweth mead and springeth the wood anew. Sing cuckoo. Owl blateth after lamb, loweth after calf a cow. Bullock starteth,
bucka verteth.
Murray sing cuckoo. Well singest thou cuckoo, nay swipe thou never knew. All right, we've rung in the solstice. When I first learned how to identify plants, and it certainly wasn't the talent I was born with, the first exercise in the first class was coppers. And I just happened to have the very same book from which I did that kind of exercise right out here in the hall. I'm coming back. Before we get started, I know you're tingling with anticipation, but I'm going to inflict on you a little bit of scientific nomenclature. You can keep it or lose it, but I have to say it. I'm honor-bound as a botanist to tell you these things. Scientific nomenclature has been around really since the 16th century. Most people credit Linnaeus, who came around 100 years later. What Linnaeus did was to classify about 6,000 organisms in a series of publications. And so a great many of the names of the plants that we know, especially those from Europe, were named by Linnaeus. And very often he took existing names, names that people had been using more or less on an informal basis. Sometimes plants were identified by long Latin descriptions. You had a whole paragraph devoted to naming a given plant. And Linnaeus's gift to us was to use the system of binomial nomenclature, that's two names per name, to identify any unique organism on the planet. So we have two parts to the scientific name. I'm going to have to assume that I can erase this.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Well, I'll be guilty together. Okay. The two parts of the scientific name are genus, uppercase, and either underlined or in italics. That is the universally accepted convention. Universally accepted, but not universally observed. I get annoyed with the Seattle newspapers when they right there in every manual of style, if they would only consult them, and species, always lowercase, and also either underlined or in italics. And who will find in the more technical books other things following genus and species? You might have a V here, a VAR, standing for variety, and that would be followed by something. Or you might have SSP for subspecies, and that would be followed by something.
Now, are they underlined or?
Yeah, the words, these words are not, but these words are. And then after that comes the name of the person who gets credit for first publishing the species name. And that might be, Douglas. And it might be abbreviated. And sometimes you'll have somebody who first named it, and then somebody else who came along and figured out that it really belonged to something else that was named previously. Well, then it gets more complicated, but we won't worry about that. The important thing is genus, species. Genus capitalized, species lowercase, and always in italics and underlined. And the plural of genus is genera. And the singular of species is species, and the plural of species is species. Mm-hmm. And if you take the S off species, you're talking about a coin. If I have any specie in my pocket, then, well, I don't. I can't buy a candy bar. So species is both singular and plural when you're talking about organism. And that's true anywhere on the planet, in any language. Okay. Now, we're going to start with non-flowering plants. The only flowering plants are those that have evolved a little bit past the conifers, and they have, as a rule, but not invariably, flowers that consist of four whorls. The word I'm saying is whorl. A whorl is just a grouping that comes together at a single joint or node. But there are four whorls in flowering plants. The outermost whorl, and these whorls are really just modified leaves. As plants evolved, certain structures within the plants became adapted to new functions through an incremental series of mutations from generation to generation. The first outermost whorl is called the calyx. Oops. C-A-L-Y-X is the calyx. And the calyx consists of, collectively, sepals. So, if we had I'll just make a schematic flower here. In cross-section. It's not pretty, but I'll dress it up a little. Okay. So this is the outermost whorl I'm talking about. Okay, our flowering cross-section. Is this, slightly flower-like here? Maybe stem? Or peduncle? Okay, the calyx is the outermost, and that's the sepals. Often in flowers, they're green. There's sort of little green things. When the flower is in bud, it's the sepals that are covering it up. And those things will unfold. And then you will see the petals, which are very often brightly colored, not for our benefit. The smell and the look of flowers are a function of the tastes of insects. So they're a tribute to the good taste, the aesthetic preferences of insects. And other pollinators that can be birds occasionally. Okay, so this is the calyx, the outermost part, which is, it's the sepals collectively. Next comes the corolla. And the corolla is a series of starts with a B. Okay. Yeah, exactly. And then come the male parts of the flower. And they are the stamens. There's a term for that. But you're going to hear enough terms, and I'm not going to give it to you as a technical term. Just think of it as the stamens. The stamens consist of two parts. Anther, I'm not listing. It really is anther. And filament. And filament is this thread-like thing. And the anther up here is the pollen sac. If you could just get rid of all of these anthers, you would never suffer from hay fever again. Of course, we would all starve. No plants would produce fruit. we'd be in dire straits. And finally is the central and last of the four modified leaves, which is called the pistil. And the pistil consists of three discrete parts. The very top, the sticky part that receives the pollen, is the stigma. And then the stalk on which the stigma rests is called a style. And then down here, containing the ovules, which contain the egg cells that get fertilized by the pollen, this is all collectively called the ovary. So, and most flowers, by no means all, but the majority of flowers have both stigmas and pistils. Have both stamens and pistils. So that basic flowering plant morphology. Now, conifers are different. It's a different structure to the flower, and we really just don't need to go into the fine details. It's enough that you know that this is the female part, which has scales, and inside these scales are born the seeds. On a fresh cone, you can shake out. Here we go. These winged seeds. These are typical of pine. That's a pine seed.
This one's without a seed, right
there.
It loses a seed. Or perhaps the seed didn't get fertilized, and so aborted. So much noise seed too. And the pollen-bearing portion, I've got two things to show that. One is this, and you might want to keep your distance. I don't know if this is. This doesn't, these pollen cones haven't opened yet. You've got pollen cones and seed cones. Pollen cones are the male, of course, and the seed cones the female part of the conifers. This one has pollen cones here. They're very lively right now. Lots of pollen available for those who want it. So, are there any questions, any observations, anything you've always been wondering about and finally have a lot of to ask?
Is that an inscription for like grasses and grains as well, as flowers, or is it a different?
It's, the basics are the same, but in grasses things are highly modified. Okay. So, grasses started with this, and then by a series of reduction and condensation of those forms developed into something quite different. Mm. Grasses still have very obvious and distinctive anthers and filaments, stamens, and pistils. In the grass, pistils typically are they have two stigmata, and the stigmata are very feathery. When you grab a grass and you can look at it under the dissecting scope and you'll see it. But this is what the a grass pistil looks like. And these things are so feathery, they're very fine, because grasses are wind pollinated. Insects don't go from grass flower to grass flower. It's strictly a matter of the wind. So the stamens of grasses, which look very much like stamens from anything else, produce prodigious amounts of pollen. Those who suffer hay fever, I don't need to tell you. And then this is carried by the wind and chances to be intercepted by these feathery fronds of the grass stigmata. So, yeah, you're not going to find sepals and petals. You're going to find other structures. I love to talk about grasses, but that's a more advanced issue. So, let's move right on and dig into our conifers. I know, you know, I set the table here and I haven't let you eat. I'm going to take you through the exercises in this book. I thought about photocopying here, but then I thought, it's an awful lot of paper. We've got several different families represented here. Well, actually not too many. Come to think of it. If I put this together with this, I'll grab that other juniper. Not giving it away. This is one family, and everything else is in the Pineaceae, the pine family.
When you say family, is that genus?
No. I'm not going to, well, I'll give you the whole taxonomic hierarchy. Taxonomy is the science of classification. And when I took biology in ninth grade, the way we learned to remember it, the mnemonic we used, this is a peeve of mine, so I may as well get it out of my system. Something that helps you remember something else is a mnemonic, like the spaces on the treble clef, F-A-C-E. Face, or the lines on the treble clef, every good boy does fine. That's the way I learned it. E-G-B-B-F. A mnemonic is not this word. This is Greek for lung. So when you think about something that helps you remember, you want to say mnemonic. Or pneumo is lung or air. Okay, so the mnemonic for the hierarchy of classification that I learned is Karen, please come out for goodness sake. Kingdom. There are five kingdoms in one very popular, currently accepted scheme. There's not a consensus about that, but it works pretty well. Please is phylum. We are in the phylum Chordata, or they may have a new name for it, it's Neuro something, but it's things with a backbone, or at least with a spinal cord. May not be a bony thing. Sharks don't have that bone. They certainly have a notochord, or a spinal cord. Kingdom, please. Class. Order. Family. Genus. Species. I'm not going to take time to give you examples of each of these levels, but
We know we're talking about the kingdom of plants. And we'll just skip right down to family level. Families are broader groupings of genera that share common characteristics that separate them from other broader groupings at more or less the same level. All of these groupings are arbitrary. There's nothing in nature that says that we have to line things up this way. We're not reading a tag that comes from the genome of these organisms. Although more and more, this classification is based on molecular information rather than on the shapes of things, or their structures, their physical structures. What people look at now is the DNA, and they compare the DNA of one organism with that of another, and with lots of others, and see how much is similar and how much is different. And from that, they can tell at what point something split off from something else, and therefore what grouping it belongs to. So when you create, just like with a family tree, you could say, here's old great-great-great-great-grandfather Angus and great-great-great-grandmother Millicent, and out of them came this and that and so forth. And if you did DNA analysis, at some point you would figure out that none of the people on this side of the line could have come from Angus's brother, because they were a separate lineage. Although they do have genes in common with Angus's brother, not enough of them. Because Angus and his brother, of course, share half of their genes. Anyway, same thing. But I digress. Family Pinaceae includes the genus Pinus, the genus, which is pines, the spruce genus, the Douglas fir genus, the subalpine fir. So all of these firs, subalpine fir and Pacific silver fir, and then another pine over here. So we have here 9 species of conifers, all of which are within a half mile of this room, in two families, and 6 genera. So the families are the cypress family, and with plants, all family names end in ACE, which is the way it's pronounced. And then we have the Pinaceae. And in the cypress family, we have the western red cedar, which is Thuja cicada. And the mountain juniper. The genera we have are genus. Which is pine. This way. Fir, this is true fir, we'll call it. Which is Aedes. Douglas fir, which is a genus all to itself. Which is, get this, Pseudo-Suga, not a very useful scientific name, because it says it's a false hemlock. Well, it's nothing like a hemlock, but we're stuck with the name, Suga. Spruce. I see ya. Okay. Now I'm we're going to see what makes it possible for us to tell one of these from another. First of all, you notice that I have cones for everything except on the juniper I've got the pollen cones. Junipers end up with a fruit that we call a berry. It's a very light fruit. Use the flavor gin. But the others, we've obviously got cones here. Cone. Cones here. There are no cones with the true firs. It's not because they don't produce cones. It's because unless you climb very high into the tree and get a green cone, they all fall off. The scales break apart, and you never get an intact cone on the ground unless you get there right after the squirrel has chewed it up and dropped it. So, that's one way that you can tell a true fir. True fir cones are cylindrical. Some of them are quite big, especially the noble fir, also the grand fir, and they stand upright on the branches. On all these others, the cones hang down. But on true firs, they stand up and then they fall apart as they mature. So, I don't have any true fir cones to show you. Be great to get hold of one. If you do find one that hasn't fallen apart, the first thing you should do is spray it with some kind of fixative, some gluey thing or plastic stuff that graphic artists use to fix their pastel. Okay, in the cypress family, this western red cedar is not a true cedar, not like the cedars of Lebanon. It's quite different. It's not even in the same family. But the cedar and the juniper are both characterized by more or less scale-like leaves. They're not single needles that stick out from branches. Occasionally you get that with junipers, but they overlap considerably and are considered scale-like because, as on a fish or a reptile, these leaves are fairly slender and overlapping. So right away, if you see something with scale-like leaves in this part of the country, if it's an evergreen or conifer, you can be pretty confident that it's going to be in the cypress family. And the two examples that we've got around here, I think the only ones that we're going to find, it's going to be either western red cedar or it's going to be the juniper. There is an incense cedar that grows in Oregon and California, but We're not going to see it around here. Inset cedar, by the way, is more than likely the wood that was in your pencils when you were in school. Nowadays, they use composites, but the old-time, you know, yellow 102 pencil that you chewed on in class, and you got sort of the fragrance or the taste of it, that was incense cedar.
Why was that chosen? Why was that?
Well, it was soft, it didn't splinter. It was, I guess, just the right consistency. And incense cedar isn't particularly good for other purposes. It doesn't have the structural properties that people like in building timber. Okay, so we've got round twigs or stems. And the one with a bluish, often fleshy cone, you know, is one of those two. And I guess we all know it's going to be the juniper. And those cones will appear later in the year, I would expect. But right now, it's quite early in the year for that thing in its season. Junipers at lower elevation may already be much farther along.
Was it the lower level of junipers that have more of a bluish tint and they're more prickly?
Yeah, there are a lot of different species of juniper. And most of the ones you see planted for landscaping are not the native species. There are a few native species that have been widely adapted for landscaping, but there are also an awful lot of non-native. And yeah, more than likely, what you see down low is not this species.
Well, it's not really pretty like this.
Yeah, you wonder why people make such use of it, but basically it's because it's easy.
I try to keep them pruned or, you know, look at them, so it's kind of hard on skin.
Yeah. Well, that pretty much covers the Pinaceae, I mean, the cypress family. We don't have to complicate this by introducing the other members of this family because they're not around here. And this is complicated enough as it is. Am I right? Okay, now we're into the pine family. I hope when I go up to Copper Basin this afternoon that I'm going to get some larch to bring down.
Oh, yeah, we've got a European larch.
Yeah.
They're so interesting.
Yeah, now larch doesn't have high standing among foresters.
It's probably not a trash tree, but
I think larches are beautiful. Mm-hmm. In fact, Aldo Leopold, who was far ahead of his time in environmental ethics and writing, wrote in the San County Almanac a little peon to the larch, which he was well familiar with in northern Minnesota. He said, I love larch. I admire the larch.
Yeah, what is the larch?
Well, they have it at the Arboretum Museums. Okay. And it's, well, they're along the northern part near Jesse Drilling. Yeah, they're unique. Well, there's one in Minnesota
Square.
What do they look like?
Larches have relatively short needles, fairly soft needles, and they come out in a bunch.
Yeah.
And sort of the branches have these little posts, and out of them come a whorl of larch leaves.
Yeah. I think they called something else. What else are they called?
Tamarisk.
Tamarisk.
In the spring,
they've got
brilliant red buds. And then in the fall, they turn a bright golden color, and they really dress up the hillside. I have some slides of larches. in all of their glory from a place in the Alpine Lakes wilderness, which is west of here. And they're standing against these sheer granite peaks, snow-covered, and this blaze of gold in the foreground.
Well, as they become adult, it really matures things that, I don't know, their kind of their branches seem so feathery.
Yeah.
We used to live in northern Minnesota and in the Chippewa National Forest, and they were just gorgeous, just around the north side and behind.
Yeah.
Do they like more moisture?
Yeah, generally they go for the wet areas, and they can stand a great deal of cold. For the most part, they're restricted either to, well, generally cold, wet areas, and sometimes very cold. They don't compete well down in the lowlands. They stay up where other people, or where other species can't survive. They do very well if you fight the competitors off for them, but they can't hold their own without human intervention at the lower elevations.
Yeah. How old would you estimate Upper Copper Basin? There's one really outstanding, really large one.
There's a science or a branch of forestry called dendrochronology, which is telling time by trees. The other way to do it is to use an increment borer, and you take a core out of the tree and then polish it, and then you can count the rings.
Do you have any idea, just to estimate, how old they might come to be here?
I'd say anywhere from 80 to a couple hundred years. I don't know how long the large is, what this natural lifespan is.
Possible?
Maybe.
And I noticed there was this very large fallen log has been there for eons. There's that grain to it, and we're trying to guess if it was tamarack or not. Near the edge of the water. And you're going up now. It's a beautiful thing.
There's a great deal I don't know about forestry, and I can't very likely tell a species by its wood. There's classes I never took.
It just seemed to us that in the given area, judging by the size of that other large one behind it, it was pretty likely. It had to have been. But the grain in it is so unusual, unique.
Yeah, well, when you've got such stressful conditions, as you find up at that elevation, very severe winters, and then in the summertime, it's extremely droughty once the snow melt is gone, and it's just no rain is falling, the soil holds no water.
Mm-hmm.
So we really have, get wrenched around by the climate. So we don't have the larch here with us. Let's take a look at the species that have needles in bunches. And I'll let you pick out which those are. I'm going to take these away because we've sort of dispensed with them for the time being.
This one has.
Okay.
What is our?
Lodgepole.
Okay, so we found one.
Five.
One down at this end has either four or five, and varies.
Varies.
This one has three.
This is what you're saying.
This isn't considered a working dog.
Right, right. And
this is tall as that.
And this has two. Some of the characteristics you're noting are from the early season growth.
That isn't considered a white pine.
Well, that's what I'm considering.
And it is. Yeah.
The comb says white
because the needles are softer. I call them soft compared to the other pines.
You're saying it's where the growth is.
Huh? Well, you know, these things have just broken bud fairly recently, and so a lot of this stuff.
They just don't seem as coarse, at least when we come from.
Well, this is a western white pine.
So that's the difference.
And yeah. You're from.
And they're Minnesota, and they're shorter.
Okay.
Needles.
Right.
And they really kind of disease prone.
Yeah. Well, there is a.
There was something that went through.
Yeah, the western white pine and the eastern white pine are two distinct species.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the one with needles in bundles of two, and these bundles are called fascicles. A fascia, F-A-S-C-I-A. Is a sheath. Symbol of authority in the Roman Empire were the fasces, and is it on a dime? No, a dime has a torch. But you've seen the bundle of rods. And sometimes with an axe sticking out the side of it. You know, bundle of rods tied together with an axe. That was the fascies. And the term fascism derives from that. And it was the supreme ruler, the authority, Il Duce, Benito Mussolini, the original fascist. But anyway, I digress. But this bundle, the fascia, in the pine family, you'll see actually, if you look closely, you might want to use the hand lens and just take a look at that. There's sometimes a little membrane. Maybe on the younger needles, you'll see it. I've got a 20-power lens and a 7-power lens. And I'm going to go grab a dissecting scope and put it out. Is that the silver space?
This is what he called that, yeah. Some fur.
No, it's fur. This is the silver fur.
That's right.
Silver.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's
silver.
Right.
Yeah.
Civic silver. Silver fur. Washington. I think that's Pinus lambertianus. Okay, so I think we've got our pine sorted out. The two-needle pine is the lodgepole. That's this one. It has the smaller cones, and these cones also are distinctively off-kilter. They're one-sided or skewed.
Asymmetrical.
Yeah.
Fire.
That's right.
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
it's kind of character.
You're looking at character. Some very old yeah. cones here. These are the only things I could get because they were on the lower branches. As a tree ages, its cone production tends to move higher and higher on the tree. And probably part of that is to aid in dispersal because the greater distance sure. they fall from, the farther from the tree they'll end up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it may also have to do with the upper branches being more productive, being able to photosynthesize more because they get more light, and therefore the sugars don't have to travel as far to nourish the seeds because the seeds have to have a concentrated dose of energy in order to make it through their first few weeks before they can start to sprout leaves and photosynthesize themselves. They just have to survive on the stored energy that's contained within the seed. So, it's more efficient to produce the cones in the places where you're producing the most fuel. But these cones, when they're younger, are a little bit longer and skinnier, or appear to be, and very tightly bound together by a resin that's produced by the tree. And that resin stays together either until the cone gets very old, as these have become, or until it's melted by the heat of fire. Lodgepole burns frequently. It tends to inhabit areas that have frequent fires. Mm-hmm. And when it burns, it releases the seeds that are bound up in those cones, and therefore it immediately repopulates the area that was burned over. So it's an adaptation that has evolved that works very well for the lodgepole to perpetuate itself. All right, Pinus ponderosa is the big tree with the puzzle bark, sort of reddish with black lines, very distinctive. Species. Ponderosa pine is hard to mistake for anything else. Even when they're quite young, they start to develop that patchwork pattern. They also have symmetrical cones with a spike at the tip of each cone scale. So when you grab hold of one, you're going to know you're dealing with one of the spiky cone species. And ponderosa cone is fairly uniform, egg-shaped, with spiky bracts.
Beautiful cone.
And the leaves are in bundles of three.
Three.
And that doesn't vary. They're long. Bundles of three, patterned bark, spiky cones, symmetrical, egg-shaped. Ponderosa pine. Western white pine. For those of you who like the scientific names, lodgepole pine. Oh, another thing I can say about lodgepole is that it has a tremendous amplitude. Yikes. We're going to have a hurry to get through the first. It grows from the coast all the way to the Rocky Mountains. On the coast, there's a variety of lodgepole called shore pine, and it's kind of stunted and gnarly, In fact, the name of lodgepole, scientific name, is Pinus contorta. Well, lodgepoles, you don't want a contorted lodgepole. It's called lodgepole, the common name, because it grows so straight. But it's called Pinus contorta because the shore pine is so gnarly and twisted because the salt air and wind tends to sculpt it like that. So, we've got Pinus contorta, Pinus ponderosa, and Pinus monticola is the western white pine.
The monticola. Is that a name or is that the...
That's the Latin name. Why is it called monticola? Right. Well, monte comes from mountain, and I'm not sure what the cola is all about.
Okay.
So, we got through the pines.
That's four. You said those are four?
Four or five.
Four or five. Four
right.
Or five.
Right. It varies. Sometimes you'll find four.
What are the other characteristics?
Okay. Well, it has a long, kind of flexible cone. Especially as they get older, quite the longest of any of the cones. They're a little bit slightly curvy, mm-hmm. often. Yeah, 4 to 5 needles per fascicle.
What is like white pine? I mean, certainly ponderosa isn't.
Right.
Is there something that we can get confused with?
Well, there are non-native pine species that are planted that could be similar. So
but primarily...
The eastern white pine is close and certainly confusable.
You mean in this area?
Yeah, general.
I don't think anything that you're going to run into around
so
here.
So when we go look for it?
Yeah. These three pines are probably the only pines you're going to encounter in this vicinity.
That's good. That makes it easy.
Yeah, in fact, aside from the larch, I don't think you're going to run into anything that's not on this table among the conifers. Okay, we've done with the pines. Let's quickly jump to the spruce. The spruce is also quite distinctive. I brought along a branch of spruce because this is one of its characteristics. When the leaves come off, they leave little pegs.
Spruce leaves pegs.
The spruce bark is flaky. Spruce bark is scale-like. You'll see it. It's just a bunch of chips that you can peel off. The spruce cones are kind of relatively small, soft, smaller than an egg. The only cones that you're liable to confuse these with, that's one other species that I might find, is a mountain hemlock. The leaves are quite different than a mountain hemlock. The tips of spruce leaves are spiky.
Yeah.
And in cross-section, a spruce leaf is going to be more or less square. I'll just slice one here. Look at it head on. Other leaves are more or less flattened, but spruce leaves are more or less square. Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at this with a hand lens,
you'll
see if I'm telling the truth here.
Isn't that unique?
You could probably get yourself
Idea.
Yes, so spiky. Spiky leaves. Flaky, scaly bark. Pegs on the stem. And small and sort of flexible cones.
And this is
sort of membranous cones. Yeah, this is Engelmann spruce, and it's the only spruce around here.
And that's Picea?
Yes, Picea Engelmannii is the spruce.
There we go.
Oh,
my
square.
Engelmannii.
Yeah, it's pretty healthy, isn't it?
Okay, so there's our spruce. Douglas fir. Douglas fir has these most distinctive cones. And I tell a little story about how the mouse is running away from the forest fire and gets no help from the cedar or the hemlock because they both have thin bark and get burned up too. But the Douglas fir, which has this thick bark, is fire resistant and invites the mouse to crawl up into its cones, and then you can see it, tail and hind feet sticking out. Now, larch also has a cone with three bracts, but the cones are different enough, and certainly you're not going to confuse the branches of a larch with Douglas fir. And larch are only going to find at higher elevation. So the Douglas fir has fairly variable needles. They can be spiky, they can be blunt. So they can be spiky like spruce or blunt like fir. Sometimes they're sort of flattened out, and sometimes they're kind of all the way around. But they're kind of yellowish. And the buds, if you find it in bud, these are all broken bud, the buds are sharply pointed. So it's got thick bark and blocky, deeply furrowed bark. Cones with three bracts. Yeah, with mice. Slightly yellow-green coloring. More or less flattened out, but you know, there are some upright. Depends on where it's growing. If it's in the shade or if it's in the sun, and you know, it's variable. And now we're down to the firs. Well, we don't have cones to worry about. You can always tell a subalpine fir from the other two common firs that you might run into by the stomates. The stomates are pores on the leaf surface or on the needle. And in the case of subalpine fir, they have stomates top and bottom. On the top, there's one row, and on the bottom, there are two. And you can see them with a hand lens. Yeah, you're going to need a hand lens to see them. But they show up quite easily with a hand lens. And look for a series of white dots.
Series of white dots?
Yeah. And the two rows on the underside and one row on the top if it's a subalpine fir. If it's a specific silver fir, it's going to have the stomates on only one side of the leaf.
Did you call
specific? Oh, specific the little silver. Tiny ones?
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
I didn't see it on that. Yeah. Well, they're pretty good, aren't they? It's
for
my eyes. Ooh.
Yeah, we can close, make this.
They are there.
Zoom in here. Mm-hmm. Trouble with zooming in is you need more of a light because you're going through more glands. But yeah, here we go. These you should be able to see well enough.
I was thinking, I think it was this one. It looked like it had all these little pores, like dark little holes in them. Would that be the sulfur?
Mm. Well, they are pores. That's what these stomata are. You're not going to see them on the top. You will see them. Well, these white lines here, that's what they, those are the stomata. Mm. And, yeah. So, here, yeah, just look at that. Can't help but see them. So those are the air vents.
Mm.
And they shut down when it's too hot and dry to keep from using their water, which means that they have to stop photosynthesizing, but it's better than dying of thirst.
Yeah. And so that you said there aren't cones for the fur.
You'll see them up in the tree.
Oh, that's
later
the one.
In the season.
Okay, that's the one.
They stand that, upright.
Yeah, you said that already.
Yeah, cylindrical.
True fur. Cylindrical cones stand upright. Forward.
Right.
No cones low. Anyway.
Yeah. And none on the ground. Subalpine fir, which is this, has the Stone Age top and bottom, and it also tends to have the needles stand up more. These, they can lie relatively flat, although they do cover the tops of the branches. I might find a grand fir. I'd like to. If I do, I could show you the difference between a grand fir and Pacific silver fir.
These are now firs are usually softer, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fir will be much easier on the hands than a spruce.
Mm-hmm. So, what you a third kind is a grand fir?
Yeah, there is a. A grand fir is could be found in this area.
This is really interesting. Thank you.
Oh, it was a pleasure. We need more time to do this, actually. I'm thinking maybe I should just do the plant ID stuff next week. Everybody really learns how to tell one thing from another.
And I was glad you did the flower parts, because one of the things we're starting to do in northern Minnesota is do a lot of wildflower looking.
Oh, yeah.
And it's fun to do that.
Yeah, what we really need is a series of classes that will, and you can easily spend a couple of hours just looking at conifers. And after that, you can spend weeks looking at the flowering plants.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thanks,
Dad.
My pleasure. I'm Richard, and you're
Mark.
Mark. Okay, we met before, didn't we?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, that's great.
Great.
Okay.